talking about Higgs decays and Higgs production. Well, we just started talking about this. So of course, the beauty of the standard model is that once you know the Higgs mass, you can compute everything. All of the couplings are predicted, just in proportion to the masses of the various particles that the Higgs boson couples to. So we had begun sort of enumerating different decay modes that the Higgs boson could have, and we started out with Higgs decays to fermions, and we computed this process. It's not too difficult. So next, there are other decays as well. So there's Higgs decaying into massive vector bosons, W plus, W minus, and also ZZ. So of course, the Higgs boson mass is only 125 GeV. It doesn't have enough energy to produce two of these particles on shell. And so this process is forbidden. For both gauge bosons on shell. So one or both must be virtual. So for example, you can have a Higgs boson decaying into Z and a Z star. And each of these Zs will decay into fermions. And so this one would decay into psi psi bar. And this one will decay into pairs of some other fermion, psi prime and psi prime bar. So in particular, this channel with the Z, Higgs to ZZ star, is very important phenomenologically, because this is one of the most important modes for finding the Higgs and measuring its mass very precisely. In particular, the channel involving leptons is known as the golden mode, because it's so experimentally clean. And so in this case, you want psi and psi prime to be leptons, electron or muons. Electrons and muons are very clean in experimental detectors, such as at the LHC. And so the signal would be Higgs decaying into ZZ star, decaying into four leptons. Leptons is just E plus E minus. E plus, E minus. The tau is more difficult to identify, but electrons and muons are very clean. All right, so here's the branching ratios, or I should say the partial widths. So Higgs to ZZ star is around 0.11 MeV, and this is around 2.6% of the branching ratio. This Higgs to WW star is around 0.88 MeV, and this turns out to be 22% total width. Okay, so Higgs decays to ZZ star, very clean. Higgs decays to WW star, not as clean. If you decay to leptons, that means you're gonna have neutrinos. It's harder to reconstruct the total mass of the Higgs. If it decays to quarks, then well, those are just, there's just lots of background for quarks, yes?
Maybe you answered when I was not there, I'm sorry. But what is a Z star? I mean, Z is not neutral, if I don't fool myself.
Yeah, it doesn't mean complex conjugate. It means virtual.
Oh, because the other one is not virtual?
Yeah, so, well, they could both be virtual. It just turns out that the largest rate is when only one of them is virtual.
Oh, so even if the Z is inside the diagram, it's real, and then it decays because he wants to?
Yeah, yeah. So, yes?
All the end products are real?
Not yeah, all the end products are real. Everything asymptotically has to be real. In the middle, it could be virtual.
Yes.
But if things can be on shell in the intermediate states, the amplitudes are largest if they are. And that's just a question of the propagator. So if I write down the propagator for the Z boson, it would be proportional to 1 over, let's say, P squared minus MZ squared plus I epsilon. So obviously this factor is largest if p squared is equal to mz squared. So it wants to be on shell. The largest rate is if as many particles are on shell as possible, but here it can only be one. All right. So then there are also very important channels, which are loop decays. And the two important channels are Higgs to gluons, and also Higgs to photons. And it turns out that these processes have the following widths, 0.35 MeV, which turns out to be 8.6% in terms of branching ratio. And this one is 6 times 10 to the minus 3 MeV, which turns out to be a very small 0.15%. So I told you that Higgs can only couple to particles with mass. And you might wonder, OK, gluons and photons are massless. But the couplings arise at one loop order. So the Higgs is not coupling directly to these massless particles, but it couples through virtual states in a loop. And we're going to compute that in a second for one of them. Now, these two channels, although they're one loop, are actually, you could argue, the most important channels that the Higgs has. Higgs to two photons is experimentally very clean as well. So this is, although it's very rare, it's experimentally clean. And this is also one of the golden modes. We've already discovered it, but this is the golden mode for discovering the Higgs. And through this channel, it was how the Higgs boson was discovered in 2012. Now, Higgs to two gluons, although it happens at a larger rate, is basically impossible to see. And the reason is that, you have Higgs decaying into two gluons. The gluons will hadronize, and so you'll just have a bunch of hadrons produced in the final state. At a hadron collider, like the LHC, you get tons of hadrons. It's really impossible to see the hadrons that get produced through the Higgs compared to hadrons that just get produced in general through proton-proton collisions. But this process is actually very important for producing the Higgs. You can imagine if Higgs can, Higgs can decay into two gluons, the Higgs can inverse decay through two gluons. You can have two gluons coming together, fusing together to produce the Higgs boson. And when you smash together two protons, you have lots of gluons. The gluon PDFs are very large. So this process is actually very important for producing the Higgs boson and in proton colliders. OK. So what we're going to do is we're going to compute this particular branching ratio. That'll be our goal. So let me write down the matrix element. So there's going to be two diagrams. So I'll call them the matrix elements for each M1 and M2. And I'll just write down what the diagrams are. So there's a Higgs. And then it couples through a top quark loop. And then it will go into two gluons like this. And then there's another diagram where the gluons are just crossed. So this is diagram one and diagram two. Now, let me label various momenta and Lorentz indices. So okay, here's the Higgs going in. It will have momentum Q. The momentum of the gluons will be P and P prime. The gluons will have color indices A and B, and Lorentz indices mu and nu. And there's going to be a loop momentum. So I'll write this as k, this is k plus q, and this is k plus q minus p. Okay. And then, okay, I won't write it down over here, but we'll see how that one will work. So Higgs couplings to gluons is actually a great way to probe the Higgs coupling to the top quark, because the Higgs cannot decay directly into top quarks. By measuring this process, you're indirectly probing this coupling. So now what we're going to do is compute this one loop amplitude. So we have an integral over momenta. Now, it's going to be finite, but there's actually kind of a subtlety, which we'll see, which means that I have to start out doing the integral using dim reg. So I need to start out by writing down the integral in d dimensions. Now, there's a minus 1 because we have a closed fermion loop. We have a trace over the fermion lines. And so there's I k slash plus mt over k squared minus mt squared. I don't need to write down the I epsilons. I gs tb gamma nu. So we started out with the fermion propagator with momentum k. Now we're just going back along the fermion line. And so I get to that vertex in the lower right corner. And so it has indices b for color and nu for the Lorentz index. And I have this other fermion propagator, the vertical one, is I k slash plus q slash minus p slash plus mt over k plus q minus p squared minus mt squared. Now I have the vertex in the upper left, upper right corner, I ds ta gamma mu. And then I have another fermion propagator, I k slash plus q slash plus mt over k plus q squared minus mt squared. And then I have the last vertex, which is the Higgs coupling. And that one is minus I mt over v. And that's it. Then the last step is I need to contract it with the polarization vectors for the gluons, and so I'll write that as epsilon mu, epsilon nu. So let me just group together all of these terms. So overall, there's a minus sign if I multiply all the factors of I and minus 1. I have gs squared. The trace I should think of as running over all of the color indices and also the Lorentz, the Dirac indices. And so I'm left with a trace over color indices of T, A, T, B. I have a factor of MT over V. I have the polarization vectors. I have an integral over momentum. I have a trace of K slash plus MT, gamma nu. K slash plus p slash. Right. So q slash minus p slash is just p prime slash. So I'll just write this. And plus mt. Then I have gamma mu. And then last I have k slash plus q slash plus mt. Okay, and that whole thing is the trace. And then I have the denominator, k squared minus mt squared. Then I have k plus p prime squared minus mt squared, and then I have k plus q squared minus mt squared. Okay, so I grouped all the terms together. So now, well, there's a series of tricks we have to go through to evaluate this one-loop integral. The first step is to rearrange the denominator using Feynman parameters. So I can write this integral as follows. I have minus ts squared trace of ta tb mt over v epsilon mu epsilon nu. And now I introduce this integration over Feynman parameters. And so that will be an integral over x, y, and z. Times 2 times a delta function of 1 minus x minus y minus z. And then I have the trace of a bunch of stuff, which is the same as the trace I had over there. And then it's divided by a denominator, which is as follows. I have k squared minus mt squared times x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared times y. And then I have k plus q squared minus mt squared times z. All of that is cubed.
Why do you need the 2 and a delta? I mean, it's an identity, basically?
It's an identity, yeah. So, You guys have computed one-loop diagrams before, okay. So hopefully it's familiar. But it's just it's essentially identity, that if I have a denominator of the form a, b, c, I can write this as integral over x, y, and z times 2. The 2 is a factor of n minus 1, where n is the number of terms in the denominator. Here I have 3, and so 3 minus 1 is 2. This is a factor of n minus 1 factorial. Then you multiply it by a delta function. And then it's over ax plus by plus cz cubed. So this is just the identity. Yes?
Do we no longer have an integral over k?
We do have an integral over k. Thank you. Yeah, I should have written that down. So we're still doing a d-dimensional integral of k. Yes.
When you take the first one, you have the mu and the nu shouldn't be free index as they are just external. I'm a bit confused why we add the polarization vector when it's.
So I'm not exactly sure. So I guess that's just a question of notation.
Okay.
So perhaps. You're right, maybe I should leave these off, and then mu and nu would be free. That part won't really matter, what I'm talking about.
At the end, we sum over all the final polarization.
Though that's not the reason why. I mean, here we're just computing an amplitude, so whether or not I can track the polarization vectors for the external state or not is up to you. Ultimately, we will have to do it because we're computing a decay rate. Okay, so the next step is we have to work with this factor in the denominator and simplify it a little bit. So I'm just going to rewrite what's in brackets in the denominator. It's k squared minus mt squared times x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared times y plus k plus q squared minus mt squared times z. So I'm going to expand all of this out. There's a k squared term for all of these terms, and so I get k squared times x plus y plus z. There's terms that are linear in k, so I'll get k dotted into p prime times y, which is a factor of 2. So I'll get 2 times k dotted into p prime times y. And then I get 2k dotted into q times z. Now I have terms like this with p prime squared. That'll give me a 0. I'll write that anyway. P prime was the momentum of the gluon. The gluon has zero mass. I also have a term that goes like q squared times z from this term here. Q squared, the momentum of the Higgs. This one doesn't go to 0, but it equals mh squared. Then I have the factors of mt. So it's just minus mt squared times x plus y plus z. And that's it. So I can rearrange these terms as follows. K. All right. So the trick that you have to do to arrange this denominator in the appropriate way is complete the square. So we want to write k plus q times p prime plus q times z squared. So this is the squared that we're completing. And so here is, I forgot a couple of things. So first of all, according to the delta function, this is equal to 1. And then this term is also equal to 1. So when I write out this term here, k squared will give me this term. The cross term is 2k dot yp prime plus qz prime. That's this term. And now I just need to subtract off the term that's this part squared. And so that's minus yp prime plus qz. Quantity squared that I subtract off. And then I just have to add in everything else. P squared z, which is mh squared. And minus mt squared. And so now we make some definitions. So we define our shifted momentum L, which is k plus y p prime plus q z. And I also want to define a mass squared, capital M squared, which is mt squared minus mh squared z, and then plus y p prime plus q z quantity squared. And now you can expand out this quantity here. You get the following. Let me just go through it. So I have mt squared minus mh squared z. And let me expand out the next term. So where I have p prime squared, that will be 0. I'll have q squared, which is mh squared, times z squared. And then the next term I have is a cross term, which is plus 2 yz p prime dotted into q. So now p prime dotted into q is equal to q minus, now let's see, what do I want to write down? Ah, right. So let's see. So we have p prime dotted into q. Q is p plus p prime. P prime squared is equal to 0. And so this is just p dotted into p prime. And then this whole thing is just 1/2 p plus p prime squared, since p squared and p prime squared are 0. So this is just 1/2 q squared, or 1/2 mh squared. So if I group the terms together, I have mt squared minus mh squared. I have a factor of z. And then I'll have 1 minus z minus y. And all of this, according to the delta function, is equal to x. And so at the end of the day, my capital M squared is mt squared minus xz mh squared. OK. Next, well, let me just rewrite where we are so far. Ts squared trace of Ta eb. We have mt over v polarization vectors. So now that we have defined our new momentum, we can just perform the shift, where instead of now doing the integral over k, we do an integral over l. So I'll write an integral ddl over 2 pi to the d. We have our Feynman parameter integral, dx dy dz times 2 delta 1 minus x minus y minus z. We have a trace of a bunch of stuff, and then over l squared minus m squared cubed. So the next step is just to evaluate the trace. And the trace is just a kind of a big mess, so I'll just expand it out for you. So there's a term that's like 16 mt squared l mu l nu minus 4 l squared mt 8 mu nu. Then there's terms that go like 4 mt cubed 8 mu nu minus 2 mt mh squared 1 minus 2 xz times 8 mu nu. And there's plus 4 1 minus 4 xz p nu p prime mu times mt. OK. So this is what you get out. These are some of the terms that you get out when you expand the trace. And I've thrown away some of the other terms, which you don't need. So I've neglected terms that are linear in L. So you can throw away anything that's linear in L just because the denominator is an even function in L. So if the numerator is an odd function in L, that will just give you 0 once I integrate over L. The other terms I've thrown away are terms that involve P mu or P prime nu. And the reason I can throw those away is because when they get contracted with the polarization vectors, they'll give you zero. Next, we can use another trick, which is that, okay, we're doing our integral in d dimensions, where I have L mu and L nu under the integral, I can replace it by 1 over d L squared times eta mu nu. Is this trick familiar? No? Okay. So you can imagine where I have this integral. If I have a term where mu and nu are different components, let's say mu is equal to 0 and nu is equal to 1, if I do the 0, the L0 integral, or the L1 integral, it's antisymmetric. And so it would just give me 0. And so it has to pick out the terms in the integral that are where mu is equal to nu. Okay? So I'm just trying to say if mu is not equal to nu, the integral vanishes. The integral is just this d-dimensional integral. So that tells me that this whole integral must be proportional to eta mu nu. And the constant of proportionality I can just get by contracting mu with nu using eta mu nu. So I can check. So let me write it the following way. So I have this integral. And I'm arguing that it's equal to some constant, which I'll just call C, times eta mu nu. Okay, so this is the main argument, that because of antisymmetry, it has to pick out terms where mu is equal to nu. Now, how do I determine this constant C? Well, let's just contract both sides with eta mu nu. This is just equal to So here, normally you would just get 4, but now we're in d dimensions, you get d. So this is c times d. And on the left-hand side, you get the following. L squared over L squared minus m squared cubed. So this tells me what this coefficient c has to be. C has to be this integral 1 over d times d-dimensional integral over L, L squared over L squared minus m squared cubed. Right. So is that clear? So then I can replace this integral. We have the factor of L, so I replace L mu nu by L squared over d. like this. So this is the trick. And of course, it didn't really depend on the particular form of the denominator. Okay, it depends on the fact that it's even. After you do the shift in momentum integral, it's even. But it doesn't depend on this being a 3, for example. And so there's just a general trick where after you do your shift integration, you can replace L mu L nu by 1 over d times L squared in a mu. Okay. So we're going to do that. Now, write down what we have. Minus gs squared, we have the trace of ta, tb. We had mt over v, all of the terms that we wrote down from the numerator are proportional to mt. So we have mt squared now. Epsilon mu, epsilon nu. We have an integral over momentum. We have our Feynman parameter integral. We have a denominator, 1 over L squared minus M squared cubed. And then we have the following stuff from the numerator. We have 16 over D minus 4. Times L squared e to mu nu. And then we have plus 2 times 2mt squared minus mh squared 1 minus 2xz times e to mu nu. And we have plus 4 1 minus 4xz times p nu p prime mu. Okay. Now the next step, you have a question?
No.
The next step is to evaluate these momentum integrals. We have two different types of momentum integrals to evaluate. There's one, momentum integral one, looks like this. So I'm doing a d-dimensional integral, and then in the numerator I have L squared. And the momentum integral two is a d-dimensional integral, and then the numerator just have one. So you may have proved in your quantum field theory course what are the expressions for these different integrals. And if you don't remember, you can just look in Peskin and Schroeder. So you get the following forms. This one is minus I over 4 pi d over 2 times d over 2 gamma 3 minus d over 2 minus 1 over gamma of 3 times 1 over m squared to the power of 3 minus d over 2 minus 1. And the second integral is I over 4 pi d over 2 times gamma 3 minus d over 2 over gamma of 3. And I have 1 over m squared 3 minus d over 2. So integral 1 is divergent. Integral 2 is finite. So in integral 2, you could just set d equals equal to 4. So if you do that, you get the following result. You get I over 16 pi squared times 1 over 2 m squared. So you might be worried that we have a divergence from integral 1. We don't. So it's divergent, but it's multiplied by a factor of 16 over d minus 4. So although the integral itself will blow up as d goes to 4, it's multiplied by something that goes to 0 as d goes to 4. So at the end of the day, we have something finite. Let's expand this integral 1. And again, because we're multiplying it by something that goes to 0 as d goes to 4, we only need to keep the divergent part of the integral. We don't need to keep any of the finite terms because they'll be multiplied by 0. So integral 1 is minus I over 16 pi squared times d over 2. Then we have a gamma of 4 minus d over 2 over gamma, over 2. Gamma of 3 is 2. Plus terms that are finite. And let me expand this gamma function. So I have d over 2. I have a 1 half. Now, if you have gamma, so as you said, d is equal to 4, the term in the gamma function is going to 0. You can expand the gamma function around the point 0. You just get 1 over the argument. And so this is 2 over 4 minus d plus dot, 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 finite, which are finite terms, using the fact that gamma of x is approximately 1 over x, or I should say is equal to 1 over x plus finite terms as x goes to 0. And so now I can write this out as I minus I over 16 pi squared 2 over 4 minus d. So the d in front here I can just set equal to 4, and so we'll cancel off 2 times 2 here, so I just have this left over. Okay, so now I can plug this into my expression.
Thanks.
So I have minus I over 16 pi squared, ds squared, the trace, mt squared over v, polarization vectors. Now I'm left with these Feynman parameter integrals. So I have a factor of, let's say, 2 here. So that will cancel off the 2 in front of the delta function. And so I'll have this Feynman parameter integral dx, dy, dz, delta of 1 minus x minus y minus z. And then I have multiplied the following. So I have minus So I had a 4 times 4 over d minus 4. Right. So let me write it like this. Sorry, it was getting kind of lost here. So this was 16 over d minus 4, a factor out of 4, and I'm left with 4 over d minus 1. And let me write the minus 1 as d over d, and so then I get 4 minus d over d. And then all of that is multiplied by my integral. So I have a 2 over 4 minus d. I have another factor of 2, which comes from the Feynman parameter integral. And then I just have a to mu nu. And then I have following. I have, let's see, this term here. So if I set d is equal to 4, this would be 0. Oh, it seems like I'm missing a term here. Oh, I see. No, that's it. But now what I'm going to do is factor out an overall factor of 1 over m squared. And so I'll just write m squared here, which is mt squared minus xz mh squared. Then I have the following terms as well. I have a 4 mt squared minus 2 mh squared plus 4xz mh squared times a to mu nu. And then I have the following as well. 4 times 1 minus 4 xz times p nu, p prime mu. And all of that is times 1 over m squared. Okay. So now some of these terms cancel off. So 4 minus d will cancel 4 minus d. The d will cancel the 4 here. And I'll just be left with a factor of 4 here. So I'll have 4 times mt squared a to mu nu. That will cancel off with a minus sign. That will cancel off this 4t squared, 4 mt squared a to mu nu. And that will cancel this. Now, everything else will stick around, and I'll have the following expression. Here's what I have. Minus I gs squared over 16 pi squared. Trace of ta tb. Mt squared over v. Epsilon mu, epsilon nu. Now for these Feynman parameter integrals, nothing depends on y. So I'm free to do the y integration just using the delta function. So I'm left with an integral over x and z. And let me just put in the limits of integration just to be explicit. So you do the first integral from 0 to 1 and the second one to 0 from 0 to 1 minus x, like this. And then you have the following. So I can factor out 4 p mu, p nu p prime mu minus 2 mh squared eta mu nu. And then it's times a factor of 1 minus 4xz over mt squared minus xz mh squared, like this. OK, so this is what you get. Yes. So we're left with this integral over the Feynman parameters. And this can be done, but it's not particularly insightful to do. So we're not going to evaluate this integral explicitly. What we will do is evaluate it within two different limits. And the top quark is heavy. It's not that heavy compared to the mass of the Higgs, but let's assume that it was. So we're going to consider the limit that mt, let's say mt squared, is much, much larger than mh squared. Even though this limit doesn't really hold, the numerical results that we get will be not too far off compared to if you do the integral exactly. So in this case, let's evaluate the integral. We have 0 to 1 dx, 0 to 1 minus x dz. And we just get rid of the h squared term in the denominator. And so we just are left with the integral of 1 minus 4xz. When you do this integral, you just get 1/3. Now, we've been carrying around this factor here. When you evaluate this trace, you just get 1/2 times the Kronecker delta of the two color indices. And lastly, this was only just one of the diagrams. And we still have to compute the other diagram as well. That diagram, which we called M2, the matrix element is M2, just gives you actually the same result as M1. And so to sum the two diagrams, you actually just need to multiply by a factor of 2. So, the final result for the matrix element, I can write in terms of alpha s, which is a gs squared over 4 pi. We have alpha s over 3 pi v epsilon mu epsilon nu times p nu p prime mu minus m squared over 2 eta mu nu times delta ab. So this is what we get for the matrix element at the end of the day. Now we can square the matrix element. So we need to be summing over all polarizations and also over all of the final state colors of the gluons. So we have this factor of alpha s over 3 pi v squared. We have a delta AB. This just gives us a factor of 8, since A and B run over from 1 to 8. Then we have these two objects contracted with each other, nu, p nu, p prime mu, minus mh squared over 2, a to mu nu, times p nu, p prime mu, minus mh squared over 2, a to mu nu. And so then our end result is just 8 alpha s squared over 9 pi squared v. And then when we square these two things together, we get a factor of mh to the fourth minus mh squared times p dot p prime. P dot p prime is mh squared over 2. So the end result is just 4 alpha s squared mh to the fourth over 9 pi squared v squared. So we've squared the matrix element. It's straightforward to write down the formula for the two-body phase space. Actually, we already did that, so I'll write it down again. So it's just 1 over 16 pi mh. There's the matrix element squared. And then the only other thing I need to do is divide by a half, since we have identical gluons. And so this part I've computed. Then I can plug in, and I get alpha s squared mh cubed over 64 pi to the third. V squared. So that's the end result for Higgs to two gluons. You can compute.
Division of 2.
What'd you say?
Well, you division by 2?
Yeah, I divided by 2 as well. Because the gluons are identical. So this is around 0.23 MeV. And 5.7% in terms of branching ratio. This 5.7% is what you get if you just evaluate this formula. But actually, higher order corrections to this, coming from QCD corrections, play a big role, and those enhance it by around 60%. Okay, so that is Higgs to two gluons. So that's all for today, and we'll continue the discussion tomorrow.